the Panic Pod. Really excited about today's episode. The title of today's episode is emetophobia, plus other phobias as well. So if you struggle with emetophobia, and this has been done in response to a lot of requests that I've had from people, but if you're like, well, emetophobia doesn't really apply to me, tune in anyway, because I think you'll learn a lot from this episode about other kind of fearful phobic behaviors. Now, joining me is a very special guest. It's a co-presenter of the Friday Night Recovery Rooms. It's the wonderful Kimberly Quinlan. How are you doing today, Kimberly?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Did you like my introduction then? I always cringe when people like introduce me.
No, I loved it. Thank you. I feel very special. It's my favorite way to feel.
For people who don't know you, what are you about? Because I'm a big fan of Kim Quinlan, but you might be listening to this going, who's Kim Quinlan? Who is Kim Quinlan?
Huh. I'm a human who is Australian. I know. You can keep booing here. I'm Australian. I live in America.
Oh, my God.
Triple boo.
I promise this will get good. Yes. This episode will get good.
Yes, I promise you I have some redeeming qualities. I am a marriage and family therapist in the state of California. I specialize in anxiety disorders and eating disorders and body-focused repetitive behaviors. And I have a particular interest in cognitive behavioral therapy and mindfulness and self-compassion. And I love doing this kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's really nice to meet like-minded therapists as well. And we'll talk a bit more about what you do at the end as well, because Kim has a really good podcast and loads of cool stuff. But let's get to the juicy subject at hand. Let's see what we can throw up for you all.
I'm
not
exactly
editing that out. That's nope. Staying in. Yep. I'm also not going to introduce things like trigger warnings. Well, the title of the episode is called Emetophobia. So what do you think it's going to be on? Emetophobia. So no, there are no trigger warnings in this. You're just going to hear it. I know I've had brief emetophobia. Let's just go in with a description. How would you describe emetophobia?
Right.
What's the definition? How would you describe it?
Right. So emetophobia is more of a clinical term. What we're really talking about here is an extreme fear around vomit or nausea. And so, yes, diagnostically, it is considered a specific phobia, as there are many, you know, needle phobias and so forth. But with emetophobia, this specific fear is of vomit. Now, nobody likes vomit. Well, very few. I'm sure there's somebody who does, but most people don't. And most people hate the idea of being nauseous. But we're not talking about those people specifically. We're talking about people who have an incredible, increased, extreme fear of vomit, so much that it impacts the quality of their life, it impacts their functioning, it basically rules everything they do in a day, right? And categorically, if you were to get diagnosed, you would need to have this fear for approximately 6 months.
Wow. I know people in my personal life that have it, and yeah, isn't just simply I'm afraid to be sick or I'm afraid to be nauseous. It's really life hindering. Mm-hmm. For some people, it's not so hindering. For some people, it's massively life hindering. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Talk us through some kind of like common presentations that you'd see with someone with emetophobia. Oh, and by the way, we'll talk about emetophobia, whether you've got emetophobia or not. The approach to emetophobia, if I'm correct, Kim, is the same approach that you apply to lots of other phobic mm-hmm. behaviors too, mm-hmm. isn't it? So if you're like, this doesn't apply to me, follow along, and actually you can apply it to your own phobia too.
But
let's stick with emetophobia just for now, because this keeps coming up. People keep asking me to do an episode on it, so
right.
So well, what's some common hypothetical presentations of emetophobia? What do these people look like? What do their lives look like?
Right, right. So they're going to have this fear, right? And the fear presents in the form of a thought, right? What if I get nauseous? What if I get sick and so forth? Like a typical what if fear. It can also present as a sensation, right? Nausea, an experience in your body, right? Sometimes it could be something as simple as a little tummy upset, right? Which will then trigger off this sort of, you know, your brain setting off an alarm bell, the fire alarm has gone off. And once you have that, and often for people with emetophobia, I have found, and I'm curious to hear your experience too, is it's a 0 to 100 anxiety. Right? Like it's so painful for them. And it's a massive panic. Often people with emetophobia also have panic disorder. But then what happens is because they're having this anxiety, they engage in behaviors to try and reduce or remove that anxiety or nausea. Right? So what they may do is they may do an avoidant compulsion to prevent it. And that's often where it spreads throughout their whole life. Right? Mm-hmm. They may avoid, if you're in college, a lot of my teen clients avoid any kind of party, any kind of drinking, any kind of drug use in fear that either they will throw up or they will witness somebody throwing up, right? Mm-hmm. They may avoid conversations with people about topics that are about nausea or medical illnesses and so forth because they don't want to even be triggered, right? So there's often some people do it to avoid it ahead of time. Then if, let's say, you're in a situation where you don't have that control and you are at the party, you may do some reassurance seeking, like, am I okay? Will I be okay? Are you going to vomit? Will you be sick? You know, how drunk are you? That's in the example of a party. So you might be doing a lot of reassurance seeking with people. Often the onset of this is in childhood. So with children, they do often engage in a lot of reassurance seeking, right? Mom, am I sick? Will I be sick? Is this chicken healthy to eat? Is this milk out of date? You know, is it safe to eat or ingest this one thing? You know, my son has had a little bit of this in his life very early on, and he would even like ask me if he was allowed to touch things, like, can I touch the playground, you know, rail? Yes, you can touch it. Will it make me sick? Could it hurt me, kind of thing? So these are common sort of presentations.
Was your cooking that bad to give him that amount of anxiety?
Exactly.
Is this chicken okay to eat, Mom? It doesn't.
Right.
Is it supposed to be pink?
I thought it was supposed to smell that way. Well, and to be honest, for him, it was the onset for him, and his went away naturally. I think it was more of a developmental thing, but it was immediately after getting a flu, right? So he did get sick and he did throw up, and that scared him immensely, right? And so, you know, so it was a lot around reassurance seeking, and we can talk about treatment later. Another one for particularly adults is sort of self-checking. Like, am I sick? Like a mental check we do with ourselves.
Oh, that's right. One of my biggest ones I've ever had. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Am I 100%? Am I 100%? Am I 100%? And right. Yeah, the nausea was the one that had my attention a lot. Well, not so much fearing being sick itself, just the nausea of what it symbolized. So I can relate to emetophobia. Not exactly in the sense of the content of the thought, but I can understand that. Yeah.
Yeah. And the hard part about that is, even if you hadn't gone to the bathroom today, you know, when you haven't been to the bathroom or your tummy's a little off today, your tummy may feel something, even though it's not a problem. Your brain will anticipate this is going to become a problem, right? So even, you know, people who have constipation or diarrhea may be super triggered by it. People who have indigestion in other areas. So, it can start from something quite small and spread very quickly. And as I said before, the other big one is avoidance, right? So you're not allowed to say the word. You're not allowed to see any movies with vomit in it. You're not allowed to, you know, it's sort of like, and often they'll make the family agree to those policies, right? Like, we don't discuss vomit and so forth. So it can spread to any area of your life.
Yeah, and you're kind of blocking it out. Some other kind of what I've had clients and people I know in personal life where they blend foods so they didn't kind of choke, and just in case they vomited. No spice, even like the basic like cumin they just wouldn't have because just in case that it gave them an upset stomach. You're right, the avoidance of movies and TV shows and you're right, the 0 to 100, it's like, but what with emetophobia, and this is what kind of where we can kind of shift onto like other phobic behaviors, and why it often links to panic disorder and panic attacks, is that over time we become convinced that the problem is the content. Mm-hmm. Whereas emetophobia, the problem isn't being sick. Mm-hmm. It's not. I don't like throwing up. And to be honest, I'm one of those that when I feel sick, I'd rather wait an hour and not throw up than, say, my friend who will just get it over and done with. Because I don't like the feeling. But at the same time, I'm not going to be like, oh, my God, I need to build my whole life around this and catastrophize 50 steps ahead before it even occurs. So I could be like, oh, well, I know people that say, oh, I can't go on holiday because I don't know the food and I don't trust the food, so I won't go on holiday because if I eat that food, then I might throw up. And if I can't throw up, then I can't get on the plane. I can't go, et cetera, et cetera. I can't go to that party because even though I don't drink, someone else might drink and then they might throw up, et cetera. It's not the throwing up, though, that's the problem. And I'll say this to every person with emetophobia. It isn't. It's the association you have with that. People with emetophobia, in my opinion, don't know about you, Kim, but like it's the same fear as someone with panic disorder, someone with agoraphobia, someone with other kind of phobic fears, and that's the fear of losing control, of the fear of being overwhelmed by your anxiety.
Or the fear of the discomfort you'll feel.
Yeah, and the fear of the discomfort you'll feel. Now, I'll move on to another discussions, phobia, in a bit. But yeah, I mean, would you agree with that? What's your definition? You shine a more descriptive and articulate light on it.
No, not at all. No, I agree exactly with what you're saying. So, some people will present to me and say, "I don't care if I need to vomit. If I need to vomit, I need to vomit." But the uncertainty around when I'm going to vomit and if I vomit is the problem.
Someone, that's really interesting.
Right. Somebody else will say, if I never want to vomit ever in my life, I refuse to vomit. I'll do whatever I can to avoid it. Right. Other people will say, I can handle it. I know it's safe. I can tolerate. I could tolerate it. It's just that I hate that feeling, that sensation. Right. Similar to a needle phobia. The two biggest phobias I treat is emetophobia and the needle phobia. And people with needle phobia are either afraid that the needle will like snap or something inside them, or they just don't like being in pain and they don't like the uncertainty of when they have pain. Like you said, like they have no control, you know, they don't. So I think there could be so many different presentations here for people. And I think every person is different, right? And often if I were to clump it together easily with all is usually it's the lack of willingness to be uncomfortable and to not have certainty over a discomfort they have to feel.
Yeah, I mean that's one of the main ingredients, isn't it, to any kind of anxious presentation, uncertainty. Talk to us more about that. What is the role that uncertainty plays, not only in emetophobia, but just in general? Why is being comfortable with uncertainty such an important thing in recovery?
Mainly because life is uncertain. So you have to make a deal with yourself on how you're going to live this life. You can either pretend that you have control when you don't, or you can accept that you don't have control. One is much less painful than the other, right? And so in this case, particularly around vomiting, or ultimately anything, is it's something you don't have control over. So the more you try to control it, the more pain and suffering you're creating. And with anxiety disorders, we usually have it around, you know, again, similar what I just said, is if you're not willing to be out of control and be uncertain, your anxiety disorder will only spread like mold, right? Because that's what it bases and pivots on, is the more you don't want to be uncertain, the more I can create a very small life for you, similar to like agoraphobia. And so 100%, it is a lot to do with being uncertain, but it's also to do with the willingness to tolerate high levels of discomfort.
Absolutely. And yeah, willful tolerance is something I bang on about in my book, Untangle Your Anxiety, to keep banging the willful tolerance drum. And absolutely, the willful tolerance to lean into uncertainty. With the emetophobia in particular, you know, I use graded exposure in my practice, because what I'll do is we'll start with maybe pictures, sounds, to evoke the anxious response, not to make someone throw up. Very, very rarely do people throw up in my practice. In fact, in my practice, no one has ever thrown up, despite I've seen lots of people with emetophobia because they're afraid they'll throw up. They misinterpret that adrenaline rush and that feeling sick as that. I have worked with people, though, that they have thrown up, and it's been the best thing that they've ever done, because they realize that, well, the amygdala realizes, oh, yeah, that was it.
That was doable.
Yeah. It was over pretty quickly. And and as you know, every time you throw up, you're like kind of, your brain rushes with dopamine and serotonin, because it's like, wow, poof, you know, there you go. I have that kickstart again. But it's that, for me, like, emetophobia is, it's more, it utilizes one of the worst forms of anxiety, which is anticipatory or anticipatory for you American people. And that's what it is. And as we know, though, with anticipatory anxiety is always worse.
Yeah.
Anticipatory anxiety is always worse than circumstantial anxiety. And actually, it's not so long ago, is it, that they've actually pinpointed that anticipatory anxiety and situational anxiety come from separate points of the brain, which is really fascinating. But it makes sense, doesn't it? It's like, so people with emetophobia, with any phobia, they'd be like, oh my God, you know, that event, imagining that event fills me with dread. And so it releases, I'm not sure the ins and outs of the neuroscience behind it yet, but it comes from one part of the brain. But then when you actually put yourself in that situation, yeah, you'll still be anxious, but it comes from a separate part of the brain. So actually, it's never the same. So the anticipation of throwing up, being sick, or the anticipation challenging agoraphobia or getting an injection, a needle phobia, is always worse than it actually happening. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's supposed to do that. That's what the fight or flight response does, isn't it? It gets you to avoid, because if it's dangerous, it's going to try and persuade you to avoid. So it's better to make it scarier in advance, so you don't, so you would avoid it altogether. But yeah, it's just, I just think, what are your comments on kind of how much is emetophobia or any phobia anticipatory anxiety rather than situational?
Almost always. Almost always. And that's often because we're exposed to things that we're not around on the daily. Because if we were around it on the daily, we would have habituated to it to some degree already. So the things that most people are afraid of are things that we don't get exposed to that often, right? The one thing to think of, to know here too, is I've had some patients who have come to me with their partners, and their partner would say, I really want to be able to fly to Jamaica, but my partner won't fly because on flights is where they've seen people throw up. And what the reporting is, the patient won't want to engage in anything, but if they have to, they'll use an anti-nausea medication, right? And so they'll say, I could do it. I'll take the anti-nausea medication. But the problem with that is there's still this outside control, right? Like, I can't tolerate it. I can only do these things if I'm using anti-nausea meds or prescription meds and so forth, similar to people using anti-panic meds, right? And so
you never get the credit. Right? You never get the credit. Something else external gets the credit.
So some people can manage their anticipatory anxiety by using a medication, but it still shows up in the areas of their life where, you know, they need to be able to do bigger, larger things. So even if you are able to avoid it, it usually shows up somewhere.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I'm familiar with that in my personal life as well. You know, it will, once you start giving credit for your ability to tolerate uncertainty to everything external from you, it will come back to bite you.
Right.
Taking like a classic case study of emetophobia or something like that, what would it look like working with you?
Sure.
Kimberly, would you go and just kick them in the stomach, show them pictures of their relatives naked, really just have a dodgy curry? What would you do?
Let's go and eat some not so good sushi. As much as that sounds fun, but it's not. Treatments actually vary. You know, I have staff that I train, and I'll say the same thing to them: is treatment for this is no different to any other anxiety disorder. Right? Because we're going to use the same techniques. So we're first going to do an assessment to make sure we've got your diagnosis right. But then following that, we're going to do a ton of psychoeducation, help you to understand what's happening in your brain and help you to understand what is happening with this specific disorder. But
this
then,
is why Kim Quinlan's on the podcast, because she does it properly.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes. And I mean, we just follow science-based procedures, right? We try not to get hairy-fairy and fluffy with things because, you know, we want to get people better. We want to get them in and out. And this is a very debilitating disorder. So we also want to instill hope, like, we've done this before. Like, this is doable. People get better. And then from there, we do actually engage in exposure therapy, right? And what that usually involves is, as you said, starting very, very small. So for some people, it's just saying the word vomit. Some of our patients come in and they won't even allow anyone to say that word. So we
great start, isn't it? Though for graded exposure, just get used to the word vomit. Mm-hmm. You know, we're saying it right now.
Right. And so we may have them write a Y or a V, depending on, you know, yuck, whatever the word is. Might write the word vomit out first if that's where they're at. We'll meet them wherever they're at, and then we'll work our way up to cartoon pictures. Then actual pictures. We might go to
of you on a night out. Yeah. Well, and the next picture is me over the toilet seat, and my husband is holding my hair back as I'm chundering into the toilet.
Exactly. No, well, I'm not going to lie. That's not far from the truth, right? So it's not. So we'll use like memes and GIFs to get people moving in that direction. Then we'll watch actual.
That's a great idea.
Right? Cartoons first, and then move our way up. Now, to some degree, at some point, they're going to have exposure to real pictures, and that you can get. It shocks me. I still to this day do not understand it, but there are incredible vomit compilations on YouTube. I have no idea who has the time to make them, but people love them, right? I'm not joking.
As a comedy reel.
People watch this for fun. They think it's funny.
Yeah, I remember there's a show actually in they don't make it anymore, but in the UK there's something called Little Britain. And there was it wasn't my favorite comedy, but there was a really good sketch on it where they pastiche some like racist middle-aged women who live in the rural countryside. And they'd stay and like, it's taking the mickey out of, you know, cultural racism in the UK. And they were like, every time that they found out that the jam wasn't made by someone white, these two middle-aged women dressed up by these guy, it was Matt Lucas and dressed up, then they would vomit like comically, like projectile vomit every time something was like mildly like not to do with white people, and that was the joke. It was taking the mick out of Middle England in America, you know, and how I was discussing stuff like that. But the comical effect of it was on every show,
right?
And you could see it, and you knew it was coming,
right?
But I'm wondering what it was like for people with emetophobia. It was like,
oh, I'm sure.
Just be like, oh, you know, oh, that's coming. Oh, gosh, oh, gosh. Yeah, yeah, I could see why, maybe. And maybe people find it funny. I don't know.
Oh, people
do. Definitely going to YouTube it after this.
There is a website. I don't know if it's still up, but it's called Rate My Vomit, where you submit your vomit pictures and then people rate it out of 10.
That's enough internet for the day, isn't it?
No, but the thing is, and this is where I appreciate it, I have no idea who has time to create these programs, but it was an amazing exposure for my clients, because every day their homework was, I want you to go on, because there's an uncertain factor there, you see. You don't have control over what you see, right? It's not like you watch the same YouTube video, you know what's coming, right? This is all based on uncertainty. So it's great for those clients, and you go on every day and you rate it. So, and then of course, like when I had a baby, I would send them photos of my baby vomiting everywhere and so forth. That's more gradual, like that's way at the top of graduation exposures, right? And so we would use that kind of exposure, but then we would also get really creative. So with all of our IMAT clients, we always pretend to vomit. So we would make vomit noises, like give me a vomit noise. Josh, can you give me one? Exactly, right?
Actually, I'm quite violent if I throw up. It's quite... The whole street can hear it.
Okay. See? And so then I would say for homework, you're to go home with your family and you're to have a vomit noise contest, right? Right. And then we make vomit. So the graduation exposure is where we make vomit. It's the most disgusting thing ever. You put like coffee grounds and ground up pineapple and beans. Ugh. You mix it up. You can buy the smell, but we don't need the smell.
This is what you've been feeding your kid. That's why your kid's got right uncertainty issues. Terrified of dinner every night.
Exactly. And then that's the final graduation exposure. Then we can go further into that. But basically, that's what treatment looks like. Once they're there, we taper off and we have them make sure that they can practice not engaging in their safety behaviors. Just like any exposure and response prevention. And that's it.
And a reminder, why is it not good to have safety behaviors?
So think of it this way. So if we're practicing exposure, right, to your fear, but every time you do that, you have a safety behavior, there's no inhibitory learning. There's no learning being done by the brain. Your brain is able to tolerate it, but then it has this belief, like, I still need these external factors. So what we do is we do the exposure. That's 50% of the work, or maybe even 40%. The other percentage is where you practice actually allowing the discomfort and allowing the physical experience instead of removing that with a safety behavior.
That's good. You mentioned a word before, one of my favorite words in therapy, particularly good for me. I properly got into swim. I've got permanent tinnitus, and I really struggled with it for several months of my life, because I didn't leave it alone. You know, I obsessed over it. So that's my mind. I do obsess over stuff. And when I obsess over something good, it's great. Magic happens. When I obsess over something that doesn't have an answer or 100% certainty, then I join everyone else on the hamster wheel of seeking certainty and triggering my anxious response and going round and round and round. The word is habituation. I mean, I've mentioned it a couple of times on this podcast, but let's give the Kim Quinlan description. What does it mean to habituate?
Right. So habituation is ultimately where once you've exposed yourself to something a certain amount of times, we learn that there is no danger in that thing, right? So if there is, let's say, I use the example I always use, which is if you've been bitten by a dog. I was bitten by a dog at a very young age. My brain naturally shut off all of the anxiety every time I saw a dog after that. So habituation would be for every time I go to see a dog, like, so for the first time I got bit, that for my brain believed that 100% of the time you will get bit. Right. If you expose yourself the second time and you didn't get bit, now your brain's going to go, okay, 50% of the time you see a dog, you'll get bit.
That's right? Really interesting. Right? I like that.
And then
so I'm not turning off.
No.
But I'm going to warn you that there's now a 50% chance you might get bit.
And then if you keep going with that exposure, your brain, it's not that we're giving it reassurance, like, oh, you'll never get bit again. Habituation allows you to learn that you may get bit, but it's that there's not a one-to-one ratio, right? And that you can tolerate the anxiety, then you have it. There is a little bit of controversy in our field around habituation, only because we've found that scientifically, if that's your goal, being that you expose yourself enough to where you don't have anxiety, you actually can then sometimes recreate this idea that you've got to try and get rid of anxiety. And we try not to do that, right? We don't.
That's a very, very good point.
Right. We don't want to teach people that anxiety is bad. We're not doing this so you habituate. We're doing this so that you know you can tolerate the anxiety. But there is a natural habituation that happens with exposure and response prevention that we celebrate, because that's why we're doing this hard, crappy work. Right? Nobody comes to me because they love putting themselves through the ringer. They're doing it because they want their life back and they want to be able to take their life back.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So kind of summarizing really, and giving my spin on emetophobia as well, you know, you're trying to teach the amygdala that the thoughts about throwing up or being sick or nausea or even feeling nauseous isn't dangerous. Because what we've got to remember is that anxiety itself causes nauseous feelings. So it can create its own fear feedback loop. I'm afraid to be sick, but also anxiety itself makes me feel nauseous. And so the only way out of this really is to practice a little bit at a time with that uncertainty. And like Kimberly said, the more you sit with uncertainty by practicing exposure and avoiding safety behaviors, what happens is you start to then teach the amygdala, hey, look, you know, I'm willing to go and lean towards this. I'm willing to see videos of doing this or see pictures of this or even say the word vomit if it's too much. I'm willing to go to that party knowing that maybe someone might, you know, be sick, even though the chances are quite unlikely. I'm willing to do all these things. I'm willing to try this food that I haven't tried before, just knowing so I can sit with uncertainty. It doesn't mean that you'll sit with uncertainty for the rest of your life, because each time you do it, as Kimberly says, it's another chalk on the board for that's me sitting with uncertainty. Interestingly, and this is, I find this so fascinating, you're quicker to recover if you come with phobias and agoraphobia. So if you come with emetophobia and agoraphobia, my clients recover quicker than someone with just emetophobia, because the goal is to practice with uncertainty in general. So I say, well, then let's leave emetophobia and see how you feel about it when we challenge your agoraphobia. And when they overcome their agoraphobia and then they measure their fears of emetophobia, I found that every time their fear is less, so much less, because they've been if that's not proof that the problem is uncertainty and your willingness to sit with it, then I don't know what is.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I think that the point there is that the good news is that even though in the moment this feels like the absolute most terrifying thing in your life, your brain can change, right? We have proof that the brain can change its reaction to it, that, you know, if we did scans of the brain post-treatment and pre-treatment, the brain does change. And so, you know, that's the beautiful work that we do.
Yeah. And again, it does habituate, or that's a fancy word for just gets used to it.
Yeah.
Gets used to that. It's willing to go with the probability. That's what habituation is. The brain just goes, I'm willing to go with the probability. Mm-hmm. You know, you know, like I used to have driving anxiety. I know that I could still crash my car or be in an accident, but I've habituated to it because I'm okay with that probability now, right? Because it's a ridiculously low probability.
Right. There are some, what I will say, just hopefully if this speaks to somebody, is there are some people who don't habituate. But the cool thing is, if the goal of therapy is I want to live my life based on my values and not based on fear, whether you habituate or not isn't a big deal. It's not a problem, right? It's, you know, a lot of this is, you know, like, again, like I'll often ask clients, why are you here? Right? Like, why are you here? What is it that you want to take back? You have to have the goal to do this crappy work. You have to have a very clear goal of what you want your life to look like, right? Because it takes a lot of courage and it takes a lot of grunt work, right?
Absolutely.
And so you have to be really clear in, you know, don't have the goal being to habituate. You probably will. Science proves that you probably will. But really get really clear on what are your goals. Do you want to be able to see your son play at football, his football game? Or do you want to be able to travel for the holidays? Do you want to be able to go to a movie and eat the popcorn with your family without having anxiety the whole time? Once you can get really clear on that goal, whether you habituate or not doesn't matter. It really becomes, you know, am I willing to ride any wave of discomfort along the way to get that goal?
Absolutely. Kimberly Quinlan, where can people find you?
Oh, so
rummaging through your bins.
Exactly. Right. Well, and that's the thing I will share is like my son
vomiting in your bins.
I will say the way my son is completely manic, he has no anxiety about vomit, mainly because every night before bed, we would all come into his room and his mom and his dad and his sister and him would do throw up noises. Like we did that for weeks.
Wow. I thought my family were backwards.
Right, this, we completely skipped the bedtime story and we went to it.
Your neighbors are there like 911.
Right.
I don't know what's happening next door.
Right, but I'm so overjoyed by this that I have this skill and I know exactly what to do and I know how to teach them how to do hard things, right? So to answer your question, sorry, I went on a tangent. You can find me at Your Anxiety Toolkit Podcast. If you're interested, I have a bunch of online courses, not with emetophobia, but on more OCD and hair pulling and skin picking. So you can get those at cbtschool.com.
We'll have to do an episode on that as well, hair pulling and skin picking.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be a good to do as well.
Yeah, it's very co-occurring with anxiety disorders. So, or you can catch me on Instagram at Kimberly Quinlan.
Yeah, and that's a good page. Loads of good stuff on there, particularly OCD related stuff. And your podcast's really good. I was a guest on it.
You were. Yeah, we did a great one on
that
panic.
That was a good one.
It was
excellent. Dropping truth bombs.
Yeah.
That was fun. Anyway, Kimberly, this won't be the last time we speak. Unless I die tomorrow, then therefore it will be. Yes. But I'll keep it in the episode so it can be a sentimental.
I'll keep the panic. I'll do an episode just for you once you die.
Yeah. No, he died from a panic attack. That would be the ultimate, ultimate end. You know, all my life saying panic attacks can't hurt you. And then he died from a panic attack. Completely erasing everything I've ever said.
Yeah, you'll see on my Instagram, like, since Josh died, I'm taking back everything I've ever said. So. Changed my mind.
You have a lovely rest of your day. I know it's it's early in the day where you are in California. I'm going to run a bath and go to bed. And I'm going to relax for the evening. You have a lovely rest of your day.
You
and
too.
People listening at home, go catch Kimberly on Instagram. Go find the stuff, CBT School. Go find me on Instagram if you've not found me yet, Anxiety Josh. And I'll speak to you soon. See you later, Kimberly.
Thank you for having me.